Mr. Henderson, Reel 15. Can we talk a little bit more about the actual problems and that were going on fighting through the bocage?
But the bocage was the worst part of any action, I think, that we've ever done. We had some very bad conditions in the Ardennes, but that was a different kind of thing. It was cold and snow and ice. But this was fighting in hedges and ditches, and the Germans knew every bush in the area. They'd been there for 4 years. They knew where to hide and where to get dug in, and they were prepared. We were coming. We had to try and break out, and they were determined that we weren't going to break out. We had to show ourselves, and they had these small, I think they were 50 millimetre, I think they were 50 millimetre Akak guns on two little wheels, and they would put a tank out, no problems. And they were waiting, and they were so easy to hide. We were tall tanks. Shermans are pretty high. They were easy to see, you know, and you poked your head out of a sunken lane, and there was one waiting for you. It was a frightening time. Everybody was shaking in the boots. You didn't know what was round the next corner. It was a terrible time for us.
The stress of moving and fighting in those conditions has been...
It was terrible. It was like walking in the dark and not knowing what... It was like walking in a minefield and frightened to tread. It was that similar kind of fear. The fear of the unknown, what was round the corner. And we lost such a lot. Quite easily, and you never saw where the shot come from.
What effect was this to have on you, as it went on day by day?
I think that effect, it affected everybody. Even now, talking about it, I can feel it even now, after all these years. It was a terrible fear. No wonder we drank the Calvados. I think that was to... our sergeants encouraged us to get some of that down you, you know? It'll calm you down. And it did. But we were so pleased once we got through that bocage country. And that wasn't until... That wasn't until about the middle of August.
Were you confined very largely to the narrow roads?
Yes, we were. And those little narrow roads had high ditches, had high embankments at either side, and you couldn't get through them. They were so steep and so hard, even that you thought what was a hedge, and you ran the tank at it, and your tank just stalled. It was solid. You just couldn't break through. Dreadful. And every little gap in the hedges was a potential hazard, you know. You were trying to cover each other, and of course German tanks had a far bigger range than what we, even if you'd seen one, he could hit you long before he hit you. On the other hand, if you did manage to creep up, you were more or less on equal terms, but you had to be very good to be creeping about and have to come across any. But what happened is he shot at one of your tanks, you saw the shot and you fired back. And that's the only way you could beat them. You would never beat them on your own.
Were the tracks and the hedgerows and the houses, of course, were they booby-trapped and mined?
Yes. Booby-traps. There was one case where we were at a large... We parked up in a large building, a large stately home, a chateau. I can't think of the name of the chateau. But it came down a real rain. It was very, very heavy rain. And we pulled in behind the chateau for the night. It would have been so nice to go in the chateau out of the rain. But no one, not even the officers, went through the front door. I dug a trench behind the left-hand corner, right-hand corner of the chateau, and got an old door, an old outhouse door over it, and two big stones so I could get in, kept it clean and dry. My friend was in an orchard adjacent to it, another driver, and his slit trench filled half up with water, and he came and got in with me in the slit trench, and we just huddled in that slit trench through the night. But nobody dare go in there because it would be booby trapped. There'd be booby traps all over this chateau.
How did the Germans use the villages you came across as you came to them?
The villages? Well, some of the villagers seemed to think that we were interrupting their lives. I'm not surprised. Caen was a beautiful city, apparently, and it was shelled, it was bombed with a terrible bombing. I think about 4,500 bombs dropped on it. Bombers came over, and 450 bombers. It was 1,000 bomber raid split into three, and it was just rubble, most part. You can understand the bitterness of those French people. We'd liberated them, yes, but what a terrible price to pay, losing the home and everything. They were walking about the streets, and there was thousands killed in there. The restaurant, the person we stayed, he was a five-year-old at the time. His mother was killed in that raid in Caen, but he said, "I've got no bitterness," he said. "It had to be done," but all French people didn't think like that, and you can't blame them. They were living... I would imagine those French villagers would be living quite peacefully with the German. They would get to know them well, and I would imagine that those German soldiers were very much like we are. They would want to make friends. It was an easier way to live, if you can live friendly. And I know for a fact that a lot of the French girls had boyfriends with the German soldiers, and they hated us for disturbing and probably killing their boyfriends.
These signs that you see so often on television of wild cheering crowds going
that,
through the villages.
Oh, that was true. I'm not saying that all French villages loved the Germans. I'm saying there would be odd cases that the lives would be interrupted, but especially in Belgium, as we entered Belgium, the villages in Belgium, they were meeting you down the road before you got to the village. They were coming out and waving the flags and shouting and climbing about on the tanks and giving you things, apples and pears and bottles of wine. And the inside of the tank, all the floor was covered in apples. You had a job to press the pedals and clamoring. How they didn't, some of them didn't get run over, I don't know. It was, if they got the feet caught, and they said, "Don't stop, for God's sake, don't stop, you'll never get started again," they'd surround it. Oh yes, there was, they just wanted to shake your hand, and the girls wanted to kiss you.
Of course, we'll come to that later. The villages themselves, the actual houses and so forth, when you came to them in Normandy, had they been heavily prepared for defence against...
Not really, I don't think so. I don't think that those French villages were fortified. There may have been, but there was pillar boxes here and there, but they were more on the coastal, and they were very, very difficult to get at. The Churchills with the flamethrowers on came up through us, and I've seen Germans coming out of those pillar boxes on fire. Dreadful. But that was the only way you could really do it. But they were coastal defences. But the villages, I can't say that those villages were fortified. Not with concrete big pillar box things.
The battles in the Bocage, as you know, were long and at times quite bitter. Ideal defensive country.
Defensive country.
How did the infantry take to you sometimes appearing on the scene amongst their positions?
Well, on the whole, the infantry liked the tanks. They had to. I mean, we were shelter for them. We could give them a lift in rather than let them walk. They used to climb on the back. But occasionally, especially when we came, they were quietly in there and they weren't getting molested. No one knew they were there. And suddenly there was a call. We had to go and come in early in the morning. And, of course, clouds of dust rose when you came into the village where they were, or in their little surround, and immediately the shelling started. Of course, we got a lot of abuse from the infantry, which was quite understandable. But on the whole, we got on pretty well. But we did get a lot of shouts, "Get them bloody things out of here." Our trucks were rubber. They didn't make an awful lot of noise. They had rubber inlays in the trucks, in between the steel, you know, but to keep the noise down. But it was the dust that brought the, and of course the smoke of the engines. I remember one case where, by mistake, someone had put diesel in the petrol engine, and of course bright blue smoke. It was early in the morning, and when he started the tank up, bright blue clouds of blue smoke, and immediately gave the game away where we were, and he had to switch it off straight away. He couldn't go in. He had to drain his tank off before he could start up again, because that attracted. That was like, like a signal, like a smoke signal to everybody, and we could understand this. Montpinken, how important it was, because they could see all these things that was happening, the dust arising, and it was a marvellous vantage point for seeing all the way around. We were only common soldiers, we didn't know, but looking back now, we realise how important that position was.
Shellfire, was it pretty bad?
Terrible. It's terrible. It came down, you were underneath your tanks, you were dug in slit trenches. The longer it went on, the worse it got. If you were stuck in your tank, you had to do your attend to the wants of nature inside. You didn't show yourself. The noise, it was the noise that, it just jarred your nerves. And the longer it went on, the worse it was. But it went on a lot. And it came suddenly. Suddenly you would maybe greasing your tank or something, and down it would come, what we called a stonk, and you'd dive for cover, and that was it. There was a case of a friend of mine who went, there was four tanks on the road, he went over to the farm for some milk. The French farmer charged him for the milk, although that farm had been liberated the day before. He came back with the milk, and on his way back, the four tanks got shelled. He waited in a break in the shelling before he ran back with the milk, and as soon as he got back to the tank, the tanks it started shelling again, and he tried to get under the front of the tank, of his tank. He couldn't get under one of his driver, a lad called Holland, Dutch Holland, was under there. So he ran round the side of the tank. It was on the main road. A shell dropped between the two tanks and spread under the tank he would have been and killed Dutch Holland. His crew commander was killed, was wounded rather. Hammond, Sergeant Hammond, was wounded at this point. And so he was made up to full corporal. He was the wireless operator. And the squadron leader made him up, said, "Well, you're in charge of this tank now." And he said, "What about this on my arm?" He said, "It won't take any notice of me if I haven't got anything." "Well, put two on there," he said. You're a full corporal." And that chap was a full corporal to the end of the war and survived. In February, he went home on leave, and his tank was handed over to another corporal. And on his way back from leave, he met some going at the Hook of Holland, and he inquired how the war was going in the last fortnight or 7 days. I forget how much leave, I think it was 7 days. Oh, he said, "It's we've got so far. Have we lost any tanks?" "Oh, yes, we lost Corporal..." It was the corporal that had relieved him. I can't just think of his name at the moment. The tank and the crew had all been killed while he'd been on leave. Had he not gone on leave, had his name not come out of the hat, he would have been killed as well. So that was two occasions where he was very, very lucky. And everyone can tell stories about that, about the near misses and "it should have been me" and things like that. There was one lad who had his name drawn out of a hat when a replacement came too many, a gunner. I never met this young lad, he'd just come. And the troop officer said, well, one gunner can have a rest. We'll put the five names in the hat from the troop. George Trelaw's name came out. He had a rest, and they took the young one in the morning. He was only 19, a lad from Hove called Banks. And the crew commander, Tommy Pink, was killed, and Banks was killed. The wireless operator, Ernie Dunn, hurt his hand, and the drivers got out all right. I don't know what happened. One was Napier and somebody else. I don't know where they went. Never seen them since the war. But that was just, had he not pulled his name out, George Trelaw would have probably have been killed.
What were the feelings on learning after a bout of shelling or fighting that
so-and-so had been killed? Just a numbness, you know. It was easier as time went on, I think. At first, when it was difficult to get used to these casualty lists, it was so sudden, you know, we were only 20-year-old. We'd only really hadn't been long out of teenagers, but as you got over it, as you got older, and as it happened, it just became the norm. Accepted it.
Was there a relief that, oh, it isn't me, and go on the next day?
In my case, it was a case of my turn will be coming. I thought it was inevitable that we should all get it in the end, but it never did. I certainly didn't expect to see the end of the campaign, and when the end came, it was a terrific relief.
And that must have had its effect upon your own, you know, psyche in a way, you know, the tension and the length.
I think everyone felt the same, but nobody spoke about it.
Did anyone break under that tension? That
only
pressure?
Once. I was going to tell you, but at Mont Pinkin, the day after Mont Pinkin, Plessy Grimald, in fact, I've just written to a chap that's doing a history of it, that was taken the following day, that would be the 7th of August, that was taken the next day, that was a small village. And did you see in that, anyway, there was one chap, he was a driver of a little scout car. And his commander was a Lance Corporal Bell, who told me that his driver, a small young chap, he'd be 20, he was young, had to leave at Plessy because his nerve went, and he'd never come back. He'd just had enough. I think that's the difference between the Second World War and the First World War. Had it been First World War, he'd probably have been shot as a coward. He didn't desert or anything. But he just reported sick, he just couldn't do his work, and he was in a bit of a bad state. And Lance Corporal Bell, Dinger Bell, told me that he was really ill and had sent him to see the MO, and the MO had sent him back down the line for treatment, but he never came back.
Did this constant pressure affect your normal functions? I'm thinking in terms of, was sleep difficult to, although you're tired, was sleep difficult to get?
I don't think it didn't stop us from sleeping. We could sleep anywhere. Certainly didn't stop us from sleeping. It didn't stop us from doing our job. We were always tired, but that wasn't because we couldn't sleep. We never got the chance to sleep. You were stood up, you were stood down, you were going into attack at 1 o'clock, you were moving out at 1 o'clock in the morning. You were moving up, you would get to the start line for six or something like that. It was delayed till 3, so you stood down for another couple of hours and you snatched a little bit of sleep, and then you moved out again at 5 o'clock in the morning. And you had it all day, and then the lack of sleep was dreadful. And even when you got your first rest, you didn't get the chance to sleep. You weren't just allowed to flop down and catch up on your sleep. There was so much to do. In fact, from our first rest, I was glad to get back into action again. And that's surprising. We had that. The first rest was at a place called Ornithorodon, And one of our tanks took the church steeple off the town. In fact, I think it was George Trelaw, because of snipers in the church steeple. But we pulled off the road down a lane, and halfway down this little lane there was two graves at the on the road as we turned down from the Inniskilling Fusiliers by the side of a monument. And halfway down the lane there was a farm with a farmyard and a bath unit in. It was the first bath unit we'd seen, and we had been bathing in rivers and in troughs in a field, cold water with a pump. We kept ourselves clean and always did our washing, but this was the first bath unit we'd seen, and it was an ordinary three-tonner that opened out, the metal parts opened out. There was a fire in the wagon. The hoses went in, and it came out of the tubular framework as hot water. And you went towards a troop at a time, and you left your tanks on the roadside. You went one at each side of the vehicle, and the people in the farm saw you doing the girls, and so nobody took any notice at all. It was rather a funny situation. And then when you came out of the other end, you went in very long, just a hot shower. You were given half the long blocks of soap cut in half that your mothers used to scrub the floor with. Do you remember the fairy soap? You got half of one of those domestic, I don't know what they call it. And then you came out the other end and you left that soap, and you were given a brand new shirt, brand new socks and a brand new pair of draw cellular. And you put them on, you put your old clothes back on again on top, got back in your tank and drove off, and the next troop went through. And we got down to the end of the lane, and there was a little concert party. It was a 1500 weight with a piano just behind the cab. And I think three or four people. It was Don Pedro, I remember, and his something, a concertina and a singer, and that was there. Before we got parked up, we had to go around there. There was a smell, and there was a body somewhere in the area. We had to find it and bury it before. That was a squadron leader, Major Cody Simpson, insisted that we find this body. And it wasn't actually a body, it was a knee that was sticking up in front of a front garden. So what we did was knock it down with spades and cover it over with soil. And told him it had been found and buried. He was a stickler for that. In fact, him and I didn't get on at all. I didn't like him. And then that night we were told, the four of us were told, we had to attend a burial party in the morning at 6:30. We had to report with shovels to this Sergeant Grimley. So we reported to Sergeant Grimley with shovels, and we went to do this burial party in the morning for people to be buried. And then... That
must have been unpleasant.
Dreadful. Perhaps. Dreadful.
How did you cope with it?
Plenty of drink, that was all. We had a good drink beforehand and went down. The worst part of it was that we had to take these to a place to bury in the 1500 weight, and we had to climb in the back behind them. And they were just in an old blanket. Put them in an old blanket and take them away.
Were they tank men?
Yeah, dreadful. Four of our lads, dreadful. We took them to a place that was pretty well back, that they were going to turn into a cemetery. Whether it was Gazelle or something, but there's no cemetery there now, so I don't know. I thought this was going to be a proper military cemetery, but apparently it wasn't. It was just going to be a temporary one. Because we visited all our graves, and that certainly wasn't one that I can remember. But anyway, we took them to this place for burial. And then the following day, we had to go to the FDS, where our recovered tanks were. I jumped onto a tank there that I knew who it was, and he was just inside the wireless operator. As I lifted the turret, flies came out, blue bottles, like a big, thick cloud, and almost knocked me off the tank. And when I looked in, I could see the chap just inside the wireless operator with the maggots crawling all over his head. Crawling with maggots, and I jumped off the tank, and for the first and last time I was sick at the side of that tank. I was never sick again, and I'd never been sick before. But seeing that somebody that I knew, that was, and this was a 4-day rest, and then we had to, these people had to be lifted out. We didn't lift them out, it was done with the MO and a crane that lifted the engines out of the tanks. And you had a single strap, and the tube was put under the single strap and lifted them out that way. If there were hole enough to lift, some of them were just nothing left much, if the shell had slipped round the tank. They were all to bury, of course. We didn't do that. Our job there was to refuel tanks that had been repaired and re-ammunition them up and get them ready for bringing back to us.
Some tank deaths, by and large, tended to be rather horrific, did they not?
Yes. There was one case, you were talking earlier on about hull-down positions. There was one tank, and it was Sergeant, I can't think of his name. The crew commander was a sergeant. He was in the tank, and we were packed up for the night. There was only him in it, and they started shelling, and we were down behind a wall or a building. I can almost see the, it was like a high wall, and a shell bounced off this wall and went into the turret, a chance in a thousand, and exploded inside the tank. There was no way to get, he never got out, and there was no way even to see, to get in until the following day, because, and when we got in, we found that the metal inside the tank was twisted with the heat. There was nothing left of him. It was, the heat in that must have been absolutely terrific. That's something else that we never realised. And I've heard of cases, although I've never saw it, of chaps that's been trapped in a tank, not Shermans, because there was an escape hatch behind the driver's compartment in the Sherman, but on the little Stuarts, if the turret was in a certain position, you couldn't get out. And there was a story of a chap that had been, the tank had been put out of action, the crew was killed in the back, and he couldn't get his turret open, and the tank was burning, and that said that they'd heard this chap screaming. I wouldn't have liked to hear that.
Was a burn-up, as they call it, the most fearful thing on your mind in going into action?
Well, brew-up, we call them a brew-up. Well, the Germans called them Tommy Cookers. That was their nickname for Shermans. And I think, yes, to be burnt, to be trapped and burned, that would have been a terrible way to die.
You'd have to force all of these visions to the back of your mind.
Yes,
yes,
all yes. As I said, there was the British Army. It's always been known for its humour, and there was always people about that could make you laugh, and I think that's what kept you going. We got our rum ration every night, and I got a double ration because one of the lads didn't. He was a cyclist with all the black gear. What do they call them? Sprint people on cycles. A sprint. And he didn't drink or smoke, and I always got his rum ration. So I had a double ration every night. That was supposed to be for the weather, for the inclement weather, but I think it was for more than that.
Anyone get drunk on it?
Oh, I don't think so. It was neat rum. It wasn't, but you weren't supposed to save it up. I think some of the lads did, and put it in a bottle. I think a lot of them did, and then they would get drunk on it. But we could get drunk on Calvados. I never saw any drunkenness though.